You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or subscribe to Brookings Podcasts through iTunes or your favorite podcast app. You can also follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Good morning. Thank you. I'm Ben Bernanke, and on behalf of Hank Paulson, Tim Geithner, and myself, I want to welcome you to this symposium on the response to the financial crisis. This symposium is being co-sponsored by the Hutchins Center on Fiscal and Monetary Policy here at Brookings Institution, David Wessel, director, and by the Yale Program on Financial Stability, Andrew Metrick, director. I want to give special thanks to David and Andrew and their teams for the tremendous work they've done, both on the logistics for these programs and the substance. In particular, we had a program, a pre-conference at Yale in March that was very good as well. So again, thanks very much to Brookings, Hutchins, and to the Yale program. When I first became chairman of the Federal Reserve in 2006, literally one of the first things I did was I asked the staff to give me the handbook on what you do in the case of a financial crisis. And they provided me a little notebook. And the notebook was typed on a manual typewriter and mimeographed and had about four pages in it. And it said, open the discount window. And that was about it. And quite seriously, quite literally, and I think Tim Geithner had a similar experience at the New York Fed, we went into one of the most complicated and consequential financial crises in human history with very little in the way of a playbook for thinking about how to address the crisis. So the question is, you know, could we do better? And could we take in particular this 10-year anniversary that we're now marking? We could sit around and swap war stories, or could we do something that would be constructive that would help future generations of firefighters be more effective in responding to whatever crisis they might face? Tim has been particularly strong in this point. He's worked with the Yale program in setting up some educational programs to help train people, who central bankers and others, who would respond to the next crisis. And we thought that for this conference, for this anniversary, we might create a new manual, a manual that would be useful, again, to future generations as they deal with whatever challenges that they will face. So what we did was we asked a lot of our senior colleagues from the time of the crisis in the various agencies to write papers on the issues that they faced, the programs they constructed, the details of how they thought about those programs, and in particular to tell us not only what they did and why, but what they thought about and didn't do and why, so that we could have a better understanding of these things and to do all this while the institutional memory is still fresh. And it was a big project, but we got tremendous response. Virtually everyone we asked to write a paper agreed to write a paper. Many of these people actually have jobs. And nevertheless, they agreed to write these substantive papers. We had some very outstanding assistants. Nellie Lang, my former colleague from the Fed, was a master editor. We had Deborah McClellan and other editors and RAs working. But in general, the authors did a great job. We have created a series of papers on various aspects of the response to the crisis. Those are now online, and those papers plus some additional papers will eventually become a book that, again, we hope will be useful to future generations. So let me just say now, and I'll say again later, but let me say again, thanks to the authors, thanks to those who contributed, to the editors, and to those who helped organize the presentations. Now, we could, of course, have had a seminar-type conference where each paper was presented, we have discussants, et cetera, but that would take 3 or 4 days. So we thought instead what we would do today is have a series of panels where the authors and others would talk about some of the major themes that these presentations and chapters have risen. So we'll turn to that in just a moment. I do want to note that, of course, today is September 11th, and I'm sure, like me, all of you remember where you were 17 years ago when we heard the news. It was, of course, a traumatic moment that in some ways began a very difficult decade for America. I hope that you will join me for a short moment of silence to remember those who died on September 11th. Thank you. What I'd like to do now is turn over the program to Nellie Lang and to Andrew Metrick, who will set the stage by talking about the arc of the crisis and some of the outcomes. And then they will in turn introduce some of the panels. So, Nellie, Andrew, thank you.
There we go. Great. Good morning. I'm Andrew Metrick. Very pleased in this audience to say I am the Janet L. Yellen Professor of Finance and Management, the Yale School of Management. And I'm going to give a little introduction. I'm going to a very short introduction, and then Nellie's going to give a short introduction, and then we will get the full day of details about this particular project. And my job is to talk about the arc of the crisis, just a little bit. Just a couple slides on that. But before I do that, I'm going to talk about the arc of knowledge about the crisis, the arc of knowledge about crises in general. Because what we saw happen over the last 10 years is very similar to the pattern for the arc of knowledge in past crises. First, we get the first thing that happens after a crisis or begins is we get detailed journalistic accounts. And we got those here. Some of them were excellent, I would say. And then following that, the economists start to look at the data, build their models. That's been going on now for almost 10 years and will continue to go on, I'm sure, for as long as we have economists. After the economists do their work, as the principals from the crisis retire from public life, we get their memoirs. We get to hear what the generals saw from the war. And that period has happened now, and now 10 years after, we're starting to see, finally, the historians come out. There's some wonderful new books of history that are starting to come out about the crisis, where we're seeing not just what happened during it, but how it made the world afterwards. But there's one thing that's missing that's very, very important, which is what not just the generals thought, but what the lieutenants thought and what they did. The people who were in charge of implementing the strategy and coming up with the tactics along the way to actually fight the crisis. In the past, we've never had that. I would love to read a book similar to the book that's going to be produced here, were it written about the Great Depression, or even about things like the Asian financial crisis. We don't have it for recent times either. Because we don't have that, the picture is missing for historians, for economists, for everybody who tries to understand what happened in the crisis. We're missing part of it. And that part of it that we're missing prevents us from making the same kinds of mistakes over and over again, for not learning the lessons of history because we don't have them written down. We never looked at them carefully enough to do that. So this is a unique project in the arc of crisis knowledge, in my view, as a crisis buff and aspiring scholar, which is that what we're going to know now is why many of these decisions were taken, what, as Ben said, why people did what they did and didn't do other things. A lot of the people who are writing these chapters, the lieutenants, so here, as Ben said, they have jobs, they have lives. Many of them, I think, from the beginning, really never wanted to think about this again. Some of them were willing to, but not all. But they all came back, which is, I think, a testament to the respect they have for who their leaders were at the time and for their just flat-out patriotism. This is really important that we learn these lessons. And I hope that over the next 2 days, you'll get a small glimpse of that and that everybody will read the whole book later when it comes out, finally. It will come out at some point, we're sure. I want to talk about the world that these generals and lieutenants were looking at just a little bit. I did it on purpose, David. It's a very complicated, tricky thing. They couldn't rearrange the slides for the last minute for me. So I've rearranged them myself, but thanks for pointing that out, David. Okay, so now what we have here is the world that was inherited by this group, which is a world that was very different than the past crises that had been fought. Which is, here you're just seeing, you know, these various colors are telling you, as a fraction of GDP, how big were these different sectors. The bottom being traditional banking, and then the lighter blue being a variety of flavors of non-bank finance. And there's many ways to tell this story. And the key idea is just look how big the light blue gets by the time we get to 2008 compared to where it was in 1980, 1970. The United States had moved away from a traditional banking system, traditional bank finance, to a place where more than half of the credit in the economy was being provided by non-bank financial intermediaries. Yet, the tools that we had to fight crises were very much tools of a different era, tools that were just from a bank-centered era. On the left-hand column are the tools that were available at that time going into the crisis for the main crisis authorities, the FDIC and the Federal Reserve. The FDIC had resolution authority for banks. So they couldn't do anything, as you can see over on the right-hand column, they couldn't do anything for a non-bank except let it go into bankruptcy or pray for a bailout. There was nothing that was in between. And they had deposit insurance for banks. The Federal Reserve had discount window lending for banks and in extremis for other institutions, but had some pretty strict rules around that lending. And they also had swap lines that they could provide, also lending for foreign central banks. It's really something to say that the advice, so Ben's only a little bit joking when he says that it was open the discount window, because the advice that we could give and what we all quoted going into the crisis was something written by a journalist from the 19th century, Walter Bagehot, who told us to lend freely against good collateral at a penalty rate. That was our apple a day keeps the doctor away, and it was pretty much all we had going into the crisis. So what are we going to do next? Well, what we're going to hear from today, see, this is the problem when it's out of order. What we're going to hear from today, everybody is talking about the various different stages and the decisions that were made, which were largely decisions that were using creative use of authority to expand into more and more of the non-bank financial system, some of the tools that were available, and actual statutory authority by going to Congress and getting the ability to do other things. The phases of the crisis here is separated in this graph into increasing stress, early escalation, and breaking the panic and resolution. Interestingly, each of these three phases starts with something happening in the non-bank sector. So the increasing stress, which we see in the summer of 2007 with a pop in the LIBOR OIS spread and bank CDS spreads, it's really around all of a sudden the realization that subprime was not going to be a limited problem, that perhaps there were places on balance sheets and in markets around the world that were infected with this disease that we didn't know about. Early escalation, this begins in early 2008, and this is after the purchase of Bear Stearns by J.P. Morgan out of what was almost certainly going to be the inevitable failure of Bear Stearns, where the Fed first invokes Section 13.3 and lends outside of the banking system. And finally, what we're here today to commemorate, not celebrate, but commemorate, is 10 years after the bankruptcy of Lehman Brothers, another non-bank financial institution in September of 2008. Where the panic finally breaks, what you see happening over the spring of 2009 is coincident with the release of the stress tests in the United States. And that was, interestingly, about banks. Well, at least at this point, Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley were now banks. So it was all banks at this point. So while it was non-banks that got us into it, it was the fear of what was going to happen broadly to the core of the financial system that had to be allayed towards the end of the crisis to finally break it. So with that, getting to the correct slide, I'm turning it over to Nelly.
Okay, with that introduction, I'm going to get to, so what was the U.S. government response? And I'm going to start with this slide, which is in the chart book, which was distributed to the authors and is available online now. So I think this chart's meant to illustrate key characteristics of the U.S. government response in 2007 to 2009. I'd say it was big and broad. It was cross-agency. It was cross-political and administrations. And it was innovative and it was bold. And all of these characteristics really were necessary to break the panic that took hold 10 years ago and get the economy back on track. And so the way to read this slide is to say the response started with a mix of traditional macro policies, monetary policy, cutting the federal funds target, and fiscal stimulus. And then it includes traditional systemic policies, those that are designed to restore the functioning of the financial system. And these include the Fed's lender of last resort function for commercial banks and currency swap lines with other central banks. After the panic broke out and Congress provided new emergency authority, policies escalated. And you just see the mass of bars there. It includes broader liquidity to firms and markets. It includes government capital and government guarantees of debt, and more aggressive monetary and fiscal policies. And combined, these policies were successful to get private sector capital back to the financial sector. So this slide is in your chart book. It's a great reference. It gives you timing. It gets you some of the policy initiations. I'm going to run through a few more. I'm not going to give nearly enough justice to some of the other responses, but it's to provide an overview, a way to sort of where do all these things fit together, and then the panels today will get into more detail. So I'm going to start with Fed. This is the basic four-page crisis handbook. Fed as lender of last resort. Initially, it provides liquidity to the banking system, domestic and foreign banks. Discount window is the smaller amount, and then it initiated something called TAF, which was used in much larger amounts. And as concerns about housing and the economy deepened, the Fed escalated from traditional to more novel and created some additional programs to support broader funding. And they used the unusual and exigent circumstances. Okay. In addition, with housing at the center of losses, the Treasury was working to get legislative authority to reduce the probability that weaknesses would bring down Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac in a highly disruptive way. So they worked to get legislation to also support the mortgage availability. And you can see that private label mortgage-backed issuance was falling, and Fannie Freddie issuance is what supported the housing market. And the two mortgage giants were put into conservatorship in early September, and government conservatorship helped to support this market. Okay. After the bankruptcy of Lehman, short-term funding markets were especially disrupted, with a prime money market fund breaking the buck. Treasury provided a temporary guarantee to the money market funds to stem investor flows. This is a chart of commercial paper maturities. And stress often shows up where everything turns very short and overnight. The money market fund guarantee stemmed investor outflows. It worked with two additional Fed liquidity programs, AMLF and CPFF, to stabilize the commercial paper market. Okay. Then when Congress passes legislation and TARP capital becomes available, policymakers can take on, implement some new actions. So turning to capital, and this is, of course, one of the high keystones people think about capital all the time. Write-downs of assets at banks had been at banks, this is commercial banks and investment banks, had risen really sharply in late 2007 and early 2008, and policymakers had been encouraging institutions to raise private capital. And you can see in this chart, 2008, the dark blue bars, the U.S. firms had raised some private capital. But this capital raising wasn't nearly sufficient. And the slowing economy and still falling house prices meant that expected losses at financial firms were still increasing. So the government response to recapitalizing the financial system is somewhat familiar to you. It went in multiple stages. The capital injections into the 9 largest firms on Columbus Day. It also offered capital to other banks to support lending. Then there was additional capital and asset ring fences for some of the more troubled banks. And then, of course, there were the stress tests in the early 2009 on the 19 largest banking firms, which were conducted with backstop government capital. And I'd mentioned the required capital was based not just on solvency, but the need to keep lending during this downturn, to keep making loans. And so the stress tests, with their extensive disclosures, led to private capital returning to the banking sector. And this dark blue bar in 2009 shows that banks raised $120 billion of private capital, more than enough to repay their TARP loans. And all but one bank repaid before the end of 2009. So I think this, at the same time, I should say, there we had, with capital, efforts to restart the securitization markets and credit flows, and to leverage private capital to do so with TALF and PPIP. Okay, and finally, a huge critical component of the overall strategy were guarantees. These were needed to prevent investor runs. The FDIC's debt guarantee program insured new debt of traditional banks, bank holding companies, and some non-banks. And combined, these with the capital led to sharp declines in bank CDS on Columbus Day weekend. Turning to macro policies, the Federal Reserve began to cut its policy rate in the fall of 2007. And when panic took hold, in a show of concerted force, central banks around the world orchestrated a coordinated interest rate cut on October 8th. And shortly after, the Fed purchased agency MBS and debt in QE1 and lowered the rate to the zero lower bound. And on the fiscal side, Treasury passed early a stimulus package in 2008, shown by the light blue bars, followed by a larger package a year later, the Recovery Act of 2009, the dark blue bars. And then there were a number of other measures, the very light blue bars, that provided some additional stimulus, especially as the effect of the Recovery Act started to wane. So summing up, with TARP capital, the combined actions of capital injections, debt guarantees, lending to restart capital markets, credit markets, and the bank stress tests with the government backstop, were able to stop the panic and bring back investors into the financial markets. And beyond 2009, the fiscal stimulus, new QE policies, and expansions in programs to reduce homeowners' mortgage payments continued to support the economy and spending. So how do we put this all together? So how do we put all this together? So in terms of outcomes, ultimately, the financial sector is to support the real economy. So one way is to look at GDP growth and employment growth. And this is a chart of government commitments in dollars to the systemic programs. This does not include the monetary and fiscal. So the Fed liquidity facilities are the dark blue, and they started early. Other includes something like Fed lending to AIG, the commitments to Fannie Freddie. There's the TARP capital. And then there's the guarantees, which are the big light blue. So these are maximum commitments. And the two lines in the chart show real GDP growth. That's the black line. and then employment growth, the blue line, which are estimated monthly year over year. And both fell very rapidly in late 2008. But you can start to see the benefits of the totality of the systemic policy responses, all the programs and their interactions. Real GDP growth starts to turn in mid to late 2009, with employment growth following the turnaround several months later. We know this recession was severe. It is useful to put it in some perspective. So what we've done is to compare this recent recession to those from previous crises using Reinhart and Rogoff. So using real GDP per capita basis, the darker blue bars show that on a real GDP per capita basis, the U.S. decline was minus 5.25% from peak to trough. It lasted about 1.5 years, and it took about 5.5 years to return to its previous peak. So in contrast, for a typical financial crisis in the Reinhart-Rogoff world, the recession is deeper, it lasts longer, and the recovery takes more time. In another paper, Romer and Romer, which is a different R&R, they look at just the OECD countries since 1970, and they have a study that indicates that given the degree of credit disruptions, and in the U.S. it was very severe, the economy performed better than would have been predicted by their model. So we believe these policy actions in totality prevented a second depression, and the recession was shorter, less steep, and the recovery more rapid than might have been expected based on past financial crises. And then there is a building body of research, which many of us document in the papers, which shows that the individual policy actions worked in the sense that they moved some desired objective in the right direction. That said, we still had a very severe recession and a weak recovery, which had substantial economic costs. And so these outcomes indicate to us that there are important lessons to take from these responses individually or combined, and for us to try to extract, beginning with why couldn't the private sector solve these problems? Why did the government need to intervene? And how could the government intervene? Policymakers clearly had to operate within their legal authorities and their constraints. And as Andrew said, the tools they had were better designed for a financial system dominated by commercial banks. But policymakers had other constraints they operated under. There was uncertainty in real time about what was happening, great uncertainty. Concerns that the actions you might take might actually cause the panic you're trying to avoid, and concerns about creating incentives for future risk-taking, sort of the moral hazard. So there are a lot of different constraints that policymakers had to operate under. So that's the goal of this project, to document how policymakers responded, whether there are lessons for future responders so that we can do better next time. So I think at this point, I think we want to turn to the panelists who, again, thank you so much for all the work. As Ben says, everyone has a day job, and it's hard to get these papers done. They're terrific. They're going to be able, through the panels today, to give you much more insight about what they did, not just what they did, but why they did and why they didn't do other things. So thank you.
Thank you, Andrew and Nelly. And if I'm David Wessel, director of the Hutchins Center. And if I could just explain a little bit the logistics for today. So we have, first of all, those slides are an excerpt of something that we're calling the graphic novel. I was on a conference call about this, and one of my cousin's kids, who's a graphic artist, says, "You're working on a graphic novel?" And I said, "This isn't quite what you think of as a graphic novel." But an enormous amount of work went into this. There's 86 slides, I believe. And because they were finished at the last minute, the printed versions will be arrive sometime before lunch. So you can have your own copy of the graphic novel suitable for autographing by the principals who are in the room. We have a series of six panels, and the panels have been asked to give highlights and illustrative examples from the papers. You can't summarize the papers in the time we have allotted, so we're going to ask people to be disciplined on the time. We've decided if you want to ask questions to write them on these cards that are at your seats, and some of the staff at Brookings will come around and collect them, and I'll pass them to the moderators. We'll have lunch, a buffet lunch, about an hour break, and we have a coffee break, and then we'll end at around 4:45 with some closing remarks from Tim Geithner and Hank Paulson. So with that, can I call up the first panel? The moderator will be Brian Sack, who's from now at D.E. Shaw, formerly of the Federal Reserve. Trish Mosier is going to be the lead speaker. She's now at Columbia, formerly with the Federal Reserve. Pat Parkinson is now at Promontory, formerly with the Federal Reserve, but also spent some time at the Treasury, and Nathan Sheets of PGIM, who was an international director at the Federal Reserve.
Thing that looks like a Wi-Fi symbol coming out, and then microphones have a habit of turning off, so make sure you turn them, push the button before you do.
Okay, great. Well, thank you. As Nelly highlighted, fighting the financial crisis took extraordinary policy efforts across a number of fronts. I think the provision of liquidity to the markets and to market participants by central banks, the Federal Reserve and other central banks, was obviously a very critical step in that process in terms of reacting to runs, preventing runs from turning into solvency issues, and if nothing else, creating more time for more comprehensive solutions. Now, the lender of last resort function is a traditional function of central banks, but of course the efforts that they undertook during the crisis were beyond the traditional in terms of the reach of those facilities, and it required a lot of innovation and creativity both to figure out what the liquidity needs were and what the right response was. So it's a pleasure to introduce this panel, this set of lieutenants. They're all senior Fed officials at the time who were really at the center of putting together these facilities and the center of that effort to respond. So on the panel, we have Pat Parkinson, who is Deputy Director of the Research and Statistics Division at the Federal Reserve Board and involved with a number of financial market issues, later moved on to become the Director of Banking Supervision at the Board. We have Nathan Sheets, who is the Director of the International Finance Division at the Board, hence frontline with many of the international efforts. And we have Trish Mosier, who was a senior official in the Markets Group at the New York Fed, and actually at the height of the crisis served as the interim SOMA manager with responsibilities for implementing a lot of these facilities. And we'll start off with Trish giving some introductory remarks.
Thank you, Brian. Good morning, everybody. So central bank liquidity provision, lender of last resort, is nearly always the first line of defense in a financial crisis, and 11 years ago was no exception to that. The timeline we've already done this morning, everybody knows it. Starting in August of 2007, the U.S. and global financial system started on a massive and very perilous deleveraging process that played out as a series of runs in wholesale funding markets, then a full-blown global financial panic, and finally causing the largest recession since the Great Depression. As the crisis progressed, the Fed created a series of innovative lender of last resort facilities for banks, for non-banks, and to provide dollar liquidity to the rest of the world. The development of those programs mirror very much the arc of the crisis that Nelly and Andrew were speaking about just a few minutes ago. The Fed started with very traditional tools, the discount window and repo operations, to provide liquidity. They didn't work. Repo operations were necessarily limited by the need to control the Fed funds rate and the size of the Fed's balance sheet. The discount window is heavily stigmatized, and it is not used by banks, even when market funding is scarce and very expensive. Instead, banks reduce their lending and their funding of customers, non-banks, and notably lending dollars abroad. It was not until December of 2007 when the Fed, in coordination with several foreign central banks, introduced two new facilities, the term auction facility, or the TAF, and the central bank swap lines. Later, they would be massively expanded, and they were, in fact, the two largest lending programs that the Fed introduced. The TAF was designed very specifically to overcome discount window stigma by auctioning discount window loans. By having all the banks bid together, there was safety and anonymity in numbers and a signal that this was a system-wide problem, not a problem with a specific institution. Importantly, the TAF facility was tied, both in policy announcement and even in operations, to the swap lines through which foreign central banks distributed dollars in their jurisdiction. The coordinated action by multiple central banks in December of 2007 sent a really clear message that the financial crisis was a global phenomenon. It would be jointly addressed. That practice had a pretty powerful impact, and it was a practice that was continued throughout the crisis. And it worked, at least for a while. The funding strains in U.S. and Europe actually eased somewhat, but they weren't enough. As Andrew pointed out earlier, two-thirds of the financial system didn't have access to central bank liquidity. A systemic crisis calls for a central bank lending to the broad financial system, basically temporarily substituting for the breakdown in private lending relationships until the system can stabilize itself. But that absolutely can't happen if the lending facility actually excludes most of the financial system. So distress at non-banks continued and accelerated, particularly in repo markets. And as we all know, by March, there was a run in repo, the failure of Bear Stearns. And for the first time since the Great Depression, the Fed invoked its emergency authorities under Section 13(3) of the Federal Reserve Act to lend to non-banks. And the non-banks they lent to were the largest security dealers who were the counterparties of the open market desk. The first two 13(3) facilities, TSLF and PDCF, I don't know why this is backwards. Sorry. I should have looked up. My apologies. The first two 13(3) facilities, the Term Securities Lending Facility and the Primary Dealer Credit Facility, both lent to the primary dealers against riskier collateral, but they were structured very, very differently. The TSLF was a term facility, security for security. It was also an auction. The PDCF was a discount window, effectively. As a result, the PDCF almost immediately became quite stigmatized, and the TSLF did not. It partly because of its auction format and also because it was similar to existing securities lending operations. So it also had an additional advantage that it didn't increase the size of the Fed's balance sheet. The programs, but in TSLF in particular, were successful in temporarily stabilizing the repo markets into the summer at least. But again, the complete meltdown in global capital and funding markets after the failure of Lehman Brothers made clear that the existing lending facilities were just not going to be enough to stop the runs. And this, by the way, was despite absolutely massive expansion of the Fed's lending programs, unlimited swap lines, effectively unlimited TAF, and the abandonment of any sense of controlling the size of the Fed's balance sheet. I have not bothered to put a line up there for the failure of Lehman Brothers because it's really obvious when it happened. In response, particularly in response to the run on money funds and the collapse of the commercial paper market, they added two additional, particularly novel facilities, the ABCP Money Fund Lending Facility and the Commercial Paper Funding Facility. They were specifically designed to backstop commercial paper markets. The AMLF lent to finance purchases of asset-backed CP bought from money funds. And in contrast, the CPFF sort of lent indirectly via a special purpose vehicle directly to issuers. Both were very novel in structure. Both were effectively non-recourse lending, and they were riskier than previous facilities. That said, they both helped to stabilize the CP market, and they certainly provided a large quantity of funding to the wholesale markets. Two words about the TALF. Only two words. It was really not a liquidity facility. It was a term asset-backed security funding facility. It was long-term lending, basically to restart the asset-backed securities market. Let me go back. The reason I want to mention TALF, though, is that it was the first, and I think only, market-wide lending facility that had an explicit Treasury credit backstop. The Fed's liquidity provision peaked at the end of 2008 as the panics and runs began to subside, and they rolled off quite quickly in 2009. The general consensus, not universal, but general consensus, is that they helped reduce the funding strains and slow down runs, but they certainly weren't enough to stop them. And one of the most important lessons to take away from all of this is that in an all-out financial panic, lender of last resort is not going to be enough. It is always going to be trumped by credible government guarantees. And in that sort of a situation, they're almost certainly going to be needed. A few lessons from the experience of 10 years ago. First, be prepared. Many of these facilities had the luxury of being created over weeks. Most were created in days and a couple in hours. And they were, as a result, not surprisingly, substantially revised and adjusted over time. Much more advanced preparation in normal times, in calm times, and testing of facilities is called for. The Fed, by the way, already does testing of monetary policy operations. It should do it for lender of last resort facilities as well. This will also, by the way, allow for earlier implementation, particularly for traditional authority facilities, assuming that they're warranted for the, by the circumstances. Now, there's an important caveat here. Every financial crisis is different, and the facilities, particularly the novel facilities that are going to be most effective in the next crisis, are not going to necessarily be the ones that were used this last time. But the financial crises do rhyme, though. Planning, thinking about the future of lender of last resort is focus on the markets that are most runnable, where you're most likely to end up having to backstop a market, and think about how a lender of last resort might be defined there, might be designed there. Lesson number two, plan internationally. In addition to the swap lines, the foreign banks borrowed more than two-thirds of the dollars lent through domestic conventional lender of last resort here in the U.S. The dollar is even more dominant as a global currency than it was 10 years ago. And its role is particularly larger in emerging markets. In the next crisis, the Fed will almost certainly face decisions about how to provide dollar liquidity to the rest of the world. The permanent swap lines are certainly an important step in that direction, but I think they're only one component of a plan. Three, plan to lend to non-banks. Traditional lender of last resort authority, is never going to be enough to handle a systemic crisis in a market-based financial system like the United States. So consider now in times of calm, how one would want to expand counterparties, one would want to expand collateral, how much risk is the Fed willing to take and in what form, when and how to do non-recourse lending. How to coordinate, really important, with the fiscal authorities. And if and as needed, how to adjust the regulatory structure. There are, of course, two ongoing challenges always with lender of last resort. One is to manage moral hazard, and the other one is to manage stigma. With moral hazard, regulatory structure is always the first line of defense there. Managing moral hazard is an ex-ante problem more than an ex-post problem. But moral hazard is also impacted by the structure of programs, by their pricing, and by collateral. And so more thinking about consistency, and there wasn't complete consistency, to be clear, across those dimensions, is important to do in advance. Stigma, of course, is a major problem for the United States in terms of lender of last resort. The lesson of the crisis is use auctions and tenders when you can. Use familiar operations. Have everyone come in at the same time. It seems to work. That said, stigma is very likely to be an even bigger issue in the next crisis because of the Dodd-Frank requirements that borrowers be identified. And I'm quite sure I'm over time, so I'm going to stop and turn it over to Brian. Thank you.
So I think it would be useful to start by digging in a bit into the breadth of the funding needs and what we might expect in the future. And I'll start with Nathan and ask... I mean, why were the dollar funding needs so extensive abroad? Is that something we should assume in a future crisis? And more importantly, does the Fed have a responsibility to meet those dollar funding needs if they reside outside the United States?
So thanks for that question. It's a pleasure to be here. I think it's useful for us to be thinking about these issues again, even though, as Andrew said, it's a bit painful. I think that the key element in thinking about this foreign demand for dollar liquidity is the key role that the dollar plays as an international currency. And as the crisis erupted, there were foreign institutions that had extensive dollar-based operations, both in the United States and in their own jurisdictions. There was extensive holding of dollar-denominated assets, and these folks needed dollar funding in order to have a matchbook. Now, at the same time, given that they were foreign institutions, they didn't have a large network of dollar-denominated retail deposits and were very dependent on the wholesale funding markets, like the FX swap market. And these were the markets that, at the height of the crisis, really got crunched. And as a result of that, foreign institutions turned to other sources. And this is when the Fed's liquidity facilities, particularly the swap line, stepped in to allow a smooth mechanism to respond to this dollar liquidity shock. In terms of the question as to whether the Fed has a responsibility to do this, I think that is a very tough question. But what I would say and what we argued in the paper is that the Fed has a strong interest in doing so. And I think this is the word that Tim Geithner used in one of the FOMC discussions, that disruptions abroad spill back into the United States. That was true 10 years ago, and I think it's even more true today. So it's very much in our interest to respond to that shock, given that the Federal Reserve is the institution that can create dollar liquidity.
And, of course, the other dimension through which the breadth of these facilities took place was support for the non-bank sector. It's been noted a couple times already that non-banks account for something like two-thirds of the credit creation in the U.S. financial system. So in some ways, it's not a surprise to have funding needs that reside outside the banking sector. I guess I would ask Pat, I mean, were you surprised by the extent of those needs? And when we look forward, you know, given a financial system that's always changing, how well can policymakers actually anticipate where in the non-bank sector these pressures might emerge and be prepared for that?
I think essentially it was not only that so much of the credit that the U.S. economy depends on is being provided by the non-bank sector, but that a substantial portion of the funding of those credit extensions was through short-term wholesale funding, particularly secured financing, where they were borrowing through instruments that provided collateral to the investors, whether that was ABCP, repos, or other instruments that the investors had regarded as relatively risk-free, such as shares in prime mutual funds. But when the investors lost confidence in the risk qualities of those instruments, they ran on them. And in each case, I think the size and speed of the runs was a surprise to me and I think to others at Fed. I think we believe that compared to, say, the kind of unsecured fundings that many banks raise in the CD markets and whatnot, that investors would stick with them because they feel even if the institution was troubled, they still had the collateral. As long as they had confidence in the value of the collateral and their ability to liquidate it promptly, they'd stick with them. But that didn't prove to be the case. So there were runs on repo, ABCP, et cetera, I say that was certainly a surprise to me. I think it must have been a surprise to others, or we would have taken more ex ante regulatory measures to require better liquidity risk management by people that relied on those types of funding vehicles. And we've been better prepared and wouldn't have to scramble as much to come up with programs to address the runs once they occurred.
Let me turn a bit to the speed of the response. I think the big picture here is there was a lot of innovation. Things happened in a remarkably timely way, given the innovation required. But I don't know, if we dig a little deeper and just ask, well, you know, were things a little too slow in some areas? Like, one example that's mentioned in your paper is that the TAF and the liquidity swap lines weren't implemented until December, whereas the funding needs really began to emerge in August. So there was a pretty meaningful gap there. So broad question, actually, for anyone on the panel, was the speed fast enough, the speed of response? Could it have been more timely? Would that have made a meaningful difference?
Since you brought up TAF and the swap lines, which sort of traditional authority tools, I'll start and then everybody else can leap in. My personal view is that it was slow. My view at the time was that it was slow. Now, there were good reasons for that. First of all, TAF existed on a piece of paper in August of 2007. The swap lines had been used exactly once after 9/11, 17 years ago. They were not the sorts of tools that you did easily or lightly, and it was pretty clear that if you introduced them that they were going to have to be around for a while. So a certain amount of operational and justifiable, I think, policymaker caution about jumping in to provide liquidity unless you're absolutely sure, with facilities that were pretty much untested, at least in the way they were going to be used. And that's completely sensible. It's one of the reasons that I think one of the lessons of this is testing traditional authority facilities in the way that monetary policy authorities are operations are tested would be very helpful, because then the decision for the policymaker is, okay, we have a facility that we know will probably work. Is this the right time to implement it or not? But the delay over the fall was a combination of all this, and not just at the Fed. I think there was certainly reluctance at the other central banks as well to think about whether they needed how quickly they needed to start these facilities. But the reality was, over the course of the fall, funding maturity shortened up, the walk maybe is a better way to describe it, in wholesale funding markets got worse, and it wasn't until December that things were done.
So I think it's clear ex post that we should have moved more quickly. Ex ante, trying to put myself back in those circumstances, there was real uncertainty about the extent of the shock. And there was also real uncertainty about the nature of these responses and the risks associated with these responses. As part of this project, I spent a fair amount of time reading some of the FOMC discussions in the transcripts. And even in early December, when the LIBOR-OIS spread had spiked and there was substantial tension in markets, the FOMC was broadly supportive. But there was a dissent, and other members of the FOMC had certain reservations. So even at that retrospectively late date, it still was not obvious to every reasonable man and woman around that table that this was a necessary response. I think having learned what we've learned, we'll respond better in the future. For example, in May of 2011, when the euro area crisis erupted, immediately the ECB turned to the Federal Reserve and proposed swap lines, and the Federal Reserve brought the swap lines back in full force. So you compare the speed of the response in that instance to the earlier instance In 2007, it was much stronger. So I do think there's been learning. And now the swap lines are standing and available. So part of it is we hadn't seen anything like this for many years, maybe since the Great Depression. And there was a lot of real-time uncertainty about the nature of what we were dealing with in the responses.
So I don't disagree with Nathan that there was a lot of uncertainty, but introducing 13-3 facilities, that's a high bar. It's always going to have to be a very significant disruption before, just for the legal standard, before those sorts of facilities are introduced. So I think another argument, if you like, for erring on the side, if you think you have a systemic liquidity problem, of erring on the side of having the traditional authority facilities ready to go is that, because you know it's going to be a gap before you can expand beyond it.
I mean, so does that mean the 13-3 facilities are just always going to be responsive? And, I mean, is there anything to note about the speed with which they were stood up?
I think one thing that we learned is, depending on the nature of the problem you're trying to solve, you may have to create a lot of new market infrastructure to be able to carry out the programs, that operationally they can be quite complex, both simply setting up the account relationships to actually lend money and take collateral from individual parties, and then all the risk management that has to go on in terms of valuing the collateral, making sure you have it, et cetera, et cetera. I think the interesting contrast is between the AMLF, where we didn't have to set up new infrastructure. We could use the discount window, and we got that up and running within a week. And the other facilities I was most closely involved with, the CPFF and the TALF, took weeks, in the case of the CPFF, and many months in the case of the TALF. And it wasn't, again, I think more or less the same people were working on those things. So it wasn't that they were working harder, but rather that just the amount of work that had to be done to safely launch some of those programs was quite large. And I think this is a point that Trish made. Even if you're not yet convinced that you need to launch a particular program, I think it would behoove the Fed to ask themselves, all right, suppose in another month we decide to pull the trigger. How long, you know, what can we do now to be able to shorten the period between the decision to launch and the time at which the credit actually reaches the financial system?
I think another important conditioning factor in thinking about this issue and the speed, and also as it applies to the 13-3 facilities, is the political environment. Through 2007 and 2008, as the Federal Reserve was putting in place these facilities, which were necessary to respond to the crisis, I hate to think what it would have looked like without this response. When Ben would go to the Hill, he was rarely greeted with hallelujahs. And even ex post in Dodd-Frank, Congress trimmed the 13-3 authority. So it is less flexible than it was before. So, we've learned some lessons, but there are other folks out there who have looked at it and have learned different lessons. And, from my perspective, that means we've got a little less ammo than we had before. But that's the political realities are another factor that we need to think about. And we're at least something of a constraint through this period.
We actually have a question from the audience that I think is relevant for this, the timing question. The question is, wasn't the monetary policy framework a significant constraint on the implementation of these facilities?
Yes. It's a short answer. The Fed did not have the ability to pay interest on reserves at that time, and the federal funds rate was positive, significantly positive, I believe, 5 and something. Someone can remind me what it was in August of 07. And it didn't get to 0 to 25 until December of 08. So until the Lehman Brothers failure, every dollar that was lent out had to be matched by shrinkage in the Fed's balance sheet. My slides aren't still up there, but I could toss up the picture of the lending. And you can see the sell-off and roll-off of U.S. Treasury securities that came out of the Fed's portfolio. So they, if you like, the Fed gave, sold or allowed to roll off Treasury securities from the balance sheet as the lending programs grew. That actually constrained the size of the growth and how quickly certain facilities were stood up. They were rolled out slowly and then grown over time. That was partly, of course, because the crisis deepened, but part of it was how quickly can we roll this off so the Fed funds rate doesn't collapse. It happened with PDCF. It happened with TAF. And after Lehman Brothers, of course, there was no attempt at that point to try to control the balance sheet. And the federal funds rate traded well below its target for most of the rest of the year until the target fell, basically, to where it was trading. I'm exaggerating slightly, but not a lot. It was also one of the reasons, of course, that the TARP legislation included speeding up of the authority of the Fed to pay interest on reserves so that it could, in fact, have both a large balance sheet and control interest rates at the same time, which in the last couple of years it's shown it can.
Maybe I should have read the rest of the question, which says, doesn't this imply that a floor system is preferable? Just in the interest of time, I'll answer that and say, I think so, yes. I think, you know, a floor system allows these decisions about liquidity support and also decisions about asset purchases to be made independent of the decisions about the short rate, which seems advantageous. Let me turn to risk. These facilities, differed a lot in terms of the type of risk they assumed or how they mitigated that risk. Right? We have the TAF that used traditional collateral that was already posted at the discount window and used counterparties for which the Fed had a lot of regulatory oversight. And then we had other facilities that were new markets, CPFF, TALF, others, where the Fed was dealing with other types of counterparties and the collateral questions were more challenging. So I guess the question is, in your view, did the risk vary meaningfully across the different facilities, and did the Fed end up kind of at the right point? I mean, in some ways, if you're lending and you have very little risk, then you're serving a pure liquidity function, and it mitigates a lot of the concerns. But in practice, you never have that situation. So just trying to get a sense of where you think the Fed ended up in practice.
I think actually, in respect to the 13-3 facilities, I think the risk did vary a lot across the facilities. We have differences of view on that among people who are actually involved in it, but louder, closer? Okay, louder. But actually, the ones I guess I was most involved with, especially the AMLF and the CPFF, I think those were pretty risky. I don't regret having launched the facilities because I think the alternative was a much more severe contraction of credit. In the end, we didn't lose money on these, although I worry that if one concluded they weren't risky because we didn't lose any money, I think that's another case of what was after the crisis, a failure of imagination. It's not hard for me to imagine how things could have gone badly, and I probably would have held accountable to some extent. But some of that was simply, again, a structural problem. As the ABCP market, 50% of the ABCP was sponsored by five banks. So I think we had a lot of concentration in those programs by virtue of that. I think it would have been a mistake to rely on the fact that they were A1, P1 rated. I don't think neither the rating agencies nor the people that were investing that paper had a particularly good idea of exactly what the collateral was backing. That's why when it started out, it was concerns about subprime collateral or mortgage collateral in general. They ended up running on all the ABC programs, even though many of them structurally were not allowed to invest in mortgage assets. So, but again, I think a key thing is you have to ask yourself, anytime you see large amounts of short-term wholesale funding in the financial system, ask yourself, is that stuff runnable? And if it did run, how would the Fed respond? Could the Fed address the run in a way that didn't pose significant risk to the Fed? And if the answer is, yes, it is runnable, and I can't think of a way the Fed can do it without taking some risk, it's time to take ex-ante regulatory measures to shrink the size of those vehicles that could give rise to the problem. And that's the right way to do it. Because once you get into the crisis, you know, the problem is if the Fed is unwilling to lend, then the balance sheets to the financial institutions are going to shrink, and that's what takes the crisis from being sort of a Wall Street crisis into being a Main Street crisis, and that's what we were trying to head off. And at the end of the day, I think the programs were successful in that regard.
I mean, on this topic of risk, I wanted to circle back to the swap lines. The swap lines were extended to 14 countries, including a number of emerging market economies. I think what is one aspect of that that's interesting is there are standing institutions that serve to combat crises in emerging markets, such as the IMF. So one question is, was it right? Does this responsibility fall to the central bank, or should it fall to those other institutions? And there's a broader question actually came from the audience about how receptive the other central banks were to the swap arrangements.
So in response to the first part of your question, I think that the size of the flows, the financial flows and other flows between the advanced economies means that backstopping those, providing liquidity in those spaces has been and is likely to always be the unique jurisdiction of the central banks. The main alternative international institution being the IMF simply doesn't have the resources to be able to provide a credible backstop. And it does broad surveillance of advanced economies, but historically, for decades at least, has not lent to them. For the emerging markets, in contrast, my feeling is and has always been that the IMF should be the first port of call for these emerging markets during times of crisis. Now, that said, I would also quickly add that there were some truly extraordinary circumstances that existed during the peak of the financial crisis that prompted the FOMC to make the decision on these swap lines. First of all, the crisis itself was exceptional, as has been articulated by a number of speakers already. Second, the resources of the IMF were significantly smaller than they are now, and with the global stresses, there is a reasonable expectation that those resources would be stretched. And then finally, the IMF had not yet developed a rapidly dispersing liquidity facility that would be appropriate for the very, very top tier of emerging market economies. So under these circumstances, the Federal Reserve felt it exceptional and approved these swap lines with four important emerging market economies. And I thought at the time, and I very much think in retrospect, that it was exactly the right thing to do. Now, given the evolution of IMF funding and the IMF suite of facilities, will those circumstances ever repeat themselves in the future? I think that the bar for it to happen, my personal view is it's exceptionally high. But if we ever see another global conflagration, hopefully it won't happen in our lifetimes, that will be a decision for some future set of policymakers.
This question says, can Tim Geithner say something? I'll answer that. Yes.
I asked David if I had to write the question down. He said no. I'm biased, and and can't claim any wisdom in hindsight. But and my tendency is to think that these the 13th Street facilities, I think, were very cool and very consequential and very important. And I think it would be better for us to run a system where this stuff was in place as a standing piece of the broader safety net for the financial system. And that would help avoid the mismatch between the scope of these protections and the structure of the financial system in the future. You guys all wave at that in your papers, but I think you should be for that. And it's not the authority is not well designed, partly because, as Trisha said, things have to be pretty terrible before you can act. Things have to be pretty far past the point of no return before you can act. And the stigma and the new law and the constraints and the are designed to make it less effective than it should be. And I think that's something we should lament and fix. But let's ask the harder question. You know, if you look back, there's no unpolluted experiment in this case, but if you look back at the outcomes from these programs, they were programs, when enacted, that were like a light switch. Spreads came down, issuance restarted, CDS compressed. And there were programs where stuff kept eroding. And in a simple way, the way to say that, you know, all the fancy lending against collateral stuff the Fed did to the non-bank system, not all of it, but where the, because that's sort of a very weak backstop, stuff eroded, kept eroding. So although I'd be for the general perspective, this is valuable stuff, important to have there in place, and earlier recourse to it is probably valuable, particularly in a situation where you have the fire sale that's going to pollute prices and raise concerns about solvency. I think there's a very good argument for doing that. I think you can look back also at this point and just say it's another example of the lesson that many of you have already said, which is that in the severe crisis, it's only the guarantee or the capital injection and the broader fiscal stuff that stops a run, reduces the incentive to run. So, I don't know. We tend to attribute a lot of coolness and consequence to this stuff. But I wonder whether you look back on this and say, well, the lesson you should take is, yeah, sure, more sooner. But it's evidence of the weakness of that part of the central bank put. And that it's another example of why, you know, if you want to protect yourself against these things, you need to have a better standing financial resources and authority to put in place tougher guarantees. You can't answer the question, what if you'd lent more freely, aggressively against broader collateral with thinner haircuts much more early? You can't answer that question, really. You don't really know. But you know that when you did it, it didn't have much effect.
So I'll just repeat what I said earlier. I agree with you that ultimately in an all-out financial panic, guarantees are always going to – it's the reason within traditional commercial banking that deposit insurance trumps lender of last resort. But it's very useful to have both. I think that's the case as well here. I will say that you don't know what the counterfactual is. You don't know whether you might have bought more time, or maybe that you would have simply, might have still needed the guarantees, but would there have had to have done as much? That's the question. This particular crisis was so severe, the idea that you weren't going to need government backstop seemed a little, seemed probably naive to me, but we didn't know that going in. It was very hard to tell in the moment. It was pretty clear that it was very systemic and global from the get-go. And having a response that policymakers would say, yes, let's do this and let's do it big and in force, could it have made the pain a bit less and the need for guarantees a little smaller? Perhaps. So the system could heal itself a little bit more. You don't know that it would have helped, but I doubt it would have been hurtful. And I think if it were well planned and well executed, the moral hazard implications of it would have been pretty small. That's my personal view.
I mean, I guess one related question, right? So in an ideal world, you have standing facilities or agreements by which you can respond to a financial crisis on a number of fronts with sort of well-defined rules and immediate availability. Obviously, that's never going to happen, and if anything, we've probably gone a step or several steps in the other direction. So I guess the related question I wanted to ask is, do increasing constraints on the ability to give guarantees or other support affect the way central banks should operate? Does it affect, should it affect their willingness to provide liquidity? And I'm not sure in which direction that goes, so I'm going to just throw that to you guys as a question.
Sure.
In which direction?
So, you know, I think if you have less powerful tools to fight a severe crisis, that means you need to be all the more aggressive up front, doing the kinds of things that Trish has articulated. Even also recognizing the reality of what Tim was saying, that as the crisis proliferates, it's not going to be the lender of last resort that solves the problem. It's more likely to be the fiscal and the guarantees. But then that also opens up a central tension in all of this, in that you're only going to get that fiscal and the guarantee from the political establishment once there's enough pain in the economy. So unless Congress writes a big check and provides a lot of fiscal authority to the technocratic establishment, which I don't see happening anytime soon, we're kind of stuck in a way where, in order for it to be bad enough for Congress to act, it's going to be at a point where all of us are shaking our heads and saying, why did it get this bad? And I don't know how to resolve that. And I think the quote-unquote reforms to the 13-3 facility have accentuated this catch-22, is you can't do 13-3 facility for a single firm. You've got to show it's a class of firms. And the only way to get a class of firms in a way that's likely to be persuasive is to let the thing proliferate and cascade for a while. So this is a tension. The only thing I can think of, going back to your initial question, is you've got to be all the more aggressive on the front end and hope that somehow the Badgett-style lending is sufficient. But it may not be in response to some shocks.
One question that came in, which I think is straightforward, is whether all these facilities would be possible going forward under Dodd-Frank. I assume we think yes.
Well, these, I think, are all what were called broad-based facilities. I mean, clearly the legislation prescribed the narrow facilities. There are other provisions of it having to do with collateralization and other things that I think are intended to make it more stringent. But I don't think interpreting that is straightforward. I think at previous conferences I've been at, various former Federal Reserve officials and both generals and lieutenants have expressed different views as to whether certain programs that we actually used during the crisis would be permissible under the new authority. So, unfortunately, it's not straightforward.
So we can, you know, talk about future crises and not knowing their exact nature and what the liquidity needs will be. But there's one area that you raise in your paper and other Fed officials have raised, which is should there be a standing facility for broker-dealers, something like the PDCF? Is that a recommendation you would make?
I think with one significant caveat or proviso, it is a recommendation we made in the paper, and that was that broker-dealers that are subject to bank-like regulation with respect to liquidity, capital, et cetera, that they should have access to some sort of standing facility. The traditional reluctance, I think, for providing a standing facility to someone that's a non-bank is that it's the moral hazard, it's competitive equity issues. But the fact of the matter is, if you look at the composition of even the primary dealer community today, I think all but two are bank-affiliated dealers, and all but a couple of those bank-affiliated dealers, the legal entity that's the primary dealer is a broker-dealer entity. And through a number of changes in the facts on the ground since the crisis, all of those are at least subject They're either parts of bank holding companies or, in the cases of the FBOs, they're now forced to form an intermediate holding company of which the broker-dealer is a sub. And the Fed, I don't think it's done it completely, but it certainly could impose the very same capital and liquidity constraints on those holding companies as on others. And if one then worries, some do, a step further, well, what about the broker-dealer entity, the sub itself? I think through the resolution planning process and these requirements for pre-positioning capital and liquidity, you pretty much get the same places you get to with an insured depository institution. So if that's the case, then it seems, yes, moral hazard is an issue, but you can deal with it in precisely the same way that you deal with it for depository institutions, and that's through ex-ante prudential regulation.
Okay, so this may be a broad summary type question. So here we are. We've been through the drill once. Presumably that's helpful in a number of ways. I think understanding the runnable nature of firms outside of banks. I think we're all Fed staff and the rest of us are probably better at thinking about financial stability risks and what measures, what warning signals to look for. You've all implemented this wide array of facilities and hammered out, you know, a number of specific issues on that implementation. We just have experience doing this. So that all seems like we're better off. On the other hand, as has been discussed, we know this was only a part of a response, and it's hard to get, you know, it's hard to anticipate the complete response in the future. There was a lot of backlash, not just to this, but to other Federal Reserve actions. And we have additional restrictions now, legislative restrictions on the ability of the Fed to serve the lender last resort role, and other government efforts. So, on net, where does this leave us? I doubt it leaves us confident, but are we better prepared for the next financial crisis?
Well,
yes or no?
Yes, but not so much because of lender of last resort. Can I put a but? which I think for most of the facilities here, one way or another, that we're discussing about, not only the individual institutions, but broadly, there would certainly be constraints, but I don't think it would make most of them impossible. The reason the financial system's safer, though, is because there's just lots more capital and less maturity transformation, particularly at the core of the system. But we know how this story goes. You don't have a financial crisis every 5 to 10 years. If you're fortunate like the United States, you have one about once every 75 years. And the degree of innovation and change in the financial system between now and then, particularly if there's small regulatory changes, which is kind of what happened before this crisis for 75 years, then you end up in a not very safe place because this system sort of innovates around. That, I think, is the danger, both from the regulatory structure standpoint as well as from the lender, potentially from the lender of last resort side. You need, I think, lender of last resort is used so seldom in the United States that we did not, as Ben mentioned at the very beginning, think about this enough beforehand in detailed ways about what we would do, even though we knew the financial system was changing in structure. So that, I think, is one of the biggest lessons, and where I'm worried that the system, by the time we get to the next crisis, may not be much safer than it was in 06 and 07. So that's my fear, now versus the future.
So I think the system is stronger as a broad statement, but particularly with respect to liquidity, which our session here has focused on. We now have greatly enhanced liquidity regulation. In addition, I think over and above the regulatory requirements, I think major financial institutions realize that they need more liquidity on their balance sheet than they thought was the case a decade ago. In addition, I think policymakers have learned important lessons from the crisis. Many of them we've discussed over the last 40 minutes or so. Now that said, I agree with Trish that for both the increased strength of the financial system and its increased liquidity and the recollection of the lessons that were learned during the financial crisis, there is a rate of decay. And I think that's one reason why projects like this one are constructive. They're hopefully what we can do by writing these papers and by having a conference like this is remind ourselves and other policymakers and help slow that rate of decay, but there is a rate of decay. And then the final point that I would make, this again very relevant to this particular panel, is we do have, as I indicated earlier, standing swap lines, so they are there and ready to go. And all of these other facilities that we've discussed, they're on the shelf. And every crisis will certainly be different, but the extensive liquidity facilities in so many different dimensions addressing so many different markets, seems to me how that couldn't help but be useful for a crisis any time in, you know, the next few decades. If it's 75 years out, then it could be a completely different financial system yet again. But for the remainder of our lifetimes, you know, it seems like that the blueprints that we established in weeks, days, or hours, depending on the facility, they're there and they're helpful and they're instructive.
Yeah, I think in that regard, it's not just the blueprints, but it's fine to create a blueprint, and it's mainly senior policy people that create the blueprints, but then you have to execute. And one of the things I think that for a good long time is going to make us stronger is the fact that particularly people at New York Fed that stood up all these programs so quickly, as long as they're around, I suspect that our ability to get things stood up quickly will be better than it was.
Okay, so extension of retirement age for New York Fed staff. That's the recommendation. Okay, I think we'll leave it there. So thank you very much to the panelists.
Thank you all. I'd like to call up the next panel, which is going to turn to the question of capital and guarantees for the banks. Nellie Lang will be the moderator. The lead speakers are Dan Jester and Lee Sachs, and other panelists are Jim Weigand and Tim Clark. For the people who are sitting in the back, if you want to standing in the back, if you want to continue to stand, you're welcome to, but there's actually plenty of seats. And I should have noted earlier, if you haven't figured it out by now, this is being live webcast, so be careful about falling asleep because you might find yourself on camera.
Okay, so thank you. This is banks. While some of the liquidity programs are sometimes a bit under the radar, very central bank, in some sense, what was done with capital and guarantees, nothing was done under the radar. This is, in some sense, one of the most successful programs. The liquidity programs were extremely successful, but these were incredibly unpopular. So we get to hear a little bit more about that. I think we'll start, Dan Jester will start, and then Lee Sachs will follow, and then we'll do some questions.
Okay, good morning. The capital purchase program was the first use of the $700 billion authority that we obtained from Congress. By early October 2008, as many of you recall, the financial system was unraveling. As just one marker of the fear that was present at the time, in the week prior to our announcement of the capital purchase plan, the S&P had its worst week since 1933. In that environment, we wanted to design a program that would rapidly recapitalize the financial system, keep it functioning for the benefit of the entire economy. We wanted to promote lending, or at least reduce the decline that would otherwise occur. And we wanted to facilitate in time additional private capital raising. We also wanted to increase market confidence and protect the taxpayers in any investments that we made. Treasury had earlier considered asset purchases, but we ultimately chose capital injections because they were faster, more powerful, and more efficient with our TARP resources. We sought to design a program that was simple and easy to implement and broadly accepted to maximize the effect. From a policy perspective, our capital program was unique in both its scale and focus. Instead of nationalizing only weak financial institutions, we would welcome all qualifying healthy banks. To do so, we had to address a number of issues. First, even after the passage of TARP, we did not have the authority to force an equity investment into any bank. Therefore, to encourage participation, we had to provide incentives rather than punishment. Further, making the investment program simple and attractive would ensure that it could be implemented quickly, which we thought was very important. Second, we wanted the program to be widely accepted and used by banks. The system as a whole was undercapitalized, and so unless that capital shortfall was addressed, the crisis would simply spread from lesser capitalized institutions to stronger institutions. Third, we wanted to avoid attaching a stigma to the institutions that participated. The week prior, the United Kingdom had announced a program for its banks, made it voluntary. The only banks who participated were the weaker banks, and they had a significant market punishment dealt out to them as a consequence. Stigma, we thought, was a real danger, and so we wanted to avoid that in our program. And to do that, we had to encourage the strong institutions to participate, and we argued that they would benefit from the actions that we were taking, and so it would be unfair for them to sit out. The healthier banks could also justify their participation in part based on the terms that we were offering, because, again, our terms were not penalty terms. It was relatively inexpensive capital. It was easy to understand. It was a 5% dividend. It was 3% of risk-weighted assets, and everyone saw the benefits of participating. We focused on preferred shares rather than common shares for three reasons. One, there are significant issues we thought attached to the government possibly becoming a significant owner of common shares. Second, the preferred, and on a related basis, secondly, the preferred would be more palatable for the participating institutions to accept on that basis. And finally, from the government's perspective, the preferred shares, since it's placed above the common shares, would offer greater protection to taxpayers. The trade-off was that the preferred shares are less high-quality capital than the common shares. While the preferred shares, we believe, would still be loss-absorbing, they're not as loss-absorbing as common. Nevertheless, it was our view that the preferred shares that we designed were in essence contingently common shares, and that in the future they could be converted from preferred to common, as was the case, as was done later in the cases of AIG and Citigroup. Another critical element of the announcement that we rolled out in early October was the FDIC's debt guarantee program of the TLGP. Both Treasury and the Fed leadership argued strongly that having the guarantee now would help, and taking that risk would help reduce potential future losses significantly. Initially, Chairwoman Sheila Bair was understandably concerned about the potential additional risk that the FDIC would be assuming, but after consultation, you know, agreed with the judgment that that was the right path to follow. The combination of the equity investments and the capital injections were very powerful. The CPP strengthened the bank balance sheets, and the TLGP permitted them to refinance their maturing debt obligations. I'll touch briefly on some assessments and lessons that we've included in our paper. Nellie mentioned that the program was both successful and hated, and that's an observation that we agree with. It was a critical component of the crisis response. It broke the panic. It recapitalized the system, and it laid the foundation for some important steps that Lee will describe in a moment. Profit was not the motive, and it shouldn't be the basis by which the program is judged. But in contrast to the projections and predictions that many made at the time, whether it be massive losses, the government, in fact, received proceeds in excess of its investment. While the program stabilized the system, because it helped the banks, that meant by extension it was going to help bankers, and which the public regarded as responsible for the crisis. That violated their fundamental sense of fairness, and that's something that we have to consider in future actions, how to deal with that conflict. Finally, I want to acknowledge and thank my co-authors and co-designers on the program, Jeremiah and David Ace and Jeremiah Norton. There was a large group at Treasury who was involved in this, and there's a large group across the regulatory community, including the Fed, the FDIC, the OCC, and elsewhere. The teamwork was a distinguishing characteristic of this program, and indeed the broader crisis response, and was a critical element to its success. Lee?
Thanks, Dan. Just on that last point, I want to emphasize that as well. I've said before that the first lesson of dealing with a financial crisis is to make sure you don't have one during a presidential transition. But if you have to, it's important that the people you're succeeding and the people you're working with are as good, smart, thoughtful as these guys were. We couldn't have asked for better partners, both during the transition and subsequently. they really did, as Dan said, lay the foundation for a lot of what we were to do over the subsequent 6 or 12 months, and can't emphasize how important that was. Our objectives as we were, the situation as we were coming in, we were still in the midst of a negative feedback loop between a declining economy, weakening economy, falling asset prices, and fears of insolvency in the banking system, and these things were all self-reinforcing. And our objective, like theirs, was to reestablish confidence in the financial system. We decided that in order to do that, we had to do two things, really. We had to continue to recapitalize the banking system, and we had to ensure that the credit markets were reflective of fundamentals and not just reflective of fire sale prices of assets, because those were heavily contributing to the downward spiral. In order to do those things, we knew we needed a lot of capital. We couldn't know how much at that time. Private estimates of losses throughout the system ranged up to $2 trillion. Although it was preliminary and very early, the Fed had done some analysis indicating that the banking system itself might require capital of around $290 billion in a stress scenario, and I forgot the exact number, I think it was $680 billion in a severe scenario. Of course, we only had at that stage around $250 to $300 billion left in TARP. So we had to bring more capital to the table. We had to amplify the resources that we had. And sometimes I use this capital decision tree. Tim reminds me that we weren't this clear about articulating this back in the day, and I confess. That's certainly true. When you need more capital, there's really only two kinds in a crisis. There's government capital and there's private capital. We evaluated, I won't get into them all here, you can all read them in our chapter, different ways we could use government capital and private capital. Ultimately, we determined that it was vitally important that we try and bring private capital to bear on the system as much as possible. There were a lot of reasons, not the least of which was we weren't sure we had enough, and we were terrified that the markets would start to believe that we didn't have enough. And so once you're in that realm, in the private realm, there's really only two ways you can do it. You can get capital to come in voluntarily. You can create an environment in which the world sees the system, markets, banks as investable, or you can coerce it. You can, and of course, you can't force private investors to write you a check. So the only way to get force private capital is through haircuts of more senior obligations. Everything we did was focused on trying to bring that private capital back in as a result. Again, we looked at a variety of ways of doing this. Ultimately, we settled on an approach that involved, as I think most here know, there were two main elements. There were the stress tests with a capital backstop. Tim did a very nice job describing the details of the stress tests and how those were developed and how they worked in the chapter. I won't get into them here. But it was a forward-looking test of the largest banks, the 19 largest banks, those who were $100 billion or more. It was forward-looking, and it was designed to show both to the banks themselves, the markets, to us, to the Fed, to everyone else, how much capital those banks would need in a more severe economic scenario and be in a position where they were strong enough to lend. Importantly, we knew going into this that any kind of credible stress test is going to involve months. It doesn't happen overnight. And we were all concerned that when you announce on February 10th that all the banks are going to go through this stress test and we'll tell you in a few months how it turns out, everyone would run. And what we were trying to do was break that pattern and stop the run. So what we did is we said that each bank at the end of the stress test would be given a period of 6 months during which they could go out and try to raise the capital privately. But if at the end of that period they were unable to do so, that the government stood by ready to invest what was necessary at a fixed price. So made this announcement on February 10th. Set the price at a discount to the prior day's closing price. Some have described it as a put on the banking system. It's probably not unfair. It was not, we didn't quite come out and say at that moment, we're going to do whatever it takes. Someone else used that phrase successfully. It essentially was that. It was an effort to try and take the most extreme tail off the table. I think everyone knows how it went from there. The stress test results came out, and each of the banks was able to raise the capital privately that the stress test indicated they would need. We didn't end up really having to put the capital in at that stage, although we were quite prepared to. You know, just going back to the capital decision tree for a second, all this capital, all this capital came in privately, but we were prepared to go to the other box, to the government box, if you will, and put in what was necessary. I'll leave it there because I see the clock ticking down. There were lots of other programs that were, part of this process. I'm tempted to go into the virtues of the PPIP, but I've been warned. I'll end it there.
Okay, thank you for both of those. So let me bring the FDIC in, and guarantees and insurance were critical to breaking the panic. Maybe could you, Jim, tell us a little bit? I think it's pretty public knowledge that the FDIC was reluctant to use guarantees, and maybe you could give us some insight as to why.
Here we go. All right, so... developing programs on the fly is not fun. And some of the earlier panelists alluded to the difficulty of developing programs very quickly that are going to be successful and satisfy the needs of the objectives associated with the program. Certainly, the FDIC as deposit insurer has insured deposits for many years, but it had not ever systemically guaranteed debt issuances. There were a few specific examples, Connell, Illinois, First Republic Bank, where the FDIC had guaranteed debt, but those were case-specific and not systemic and programmatic. So when the FDIC... was posed with this question, I think everybody recognized the need for it. I mean, the interbank lending had basically died. There was a severe need that I think everybody recognized. The question was, one, did the FDIC have the authority to actually do it? And so, in other words, this is outside of insuring deposits. So was there the basic authority within the FDIC's programs to... execute such a program as a debt guarantee program? And the second question was basically there was this exception that would have to be used called the systemic risk exception. And even though the agencies that participate in making that decision had worked out a protocol prior to the crisis on how to come about deciding on whether to invoke the systemic risk exception, this would have been basically a novel use of that interpretation because everybody had been thinking in terms of institution-specific invocation. And, in fact, prior to the debt guarantee program, it was used for a single bank resolution or prospective bank resolution, but it had not been used for a systemic-type program. So there was the question of authority, whether or not there was the ability to, within the FDIC's authority to do this. There's the question of using the systemic risk exception. And then, of course, there was just the mechanics. There was just developing the program on the fly, whether or not, given the FDIC's background associated with deposit insurance, whether or not it basically was going to hit the right buttons associated with the guarantee program. And quite frankly, we didn't. I mean, there are a few areas where we kind of missed it. I mean, one for as an example was what constituted a default and when payment would be made. The FDIC, of course, typically looks at when a bank fails is the point in which the deposit insurance guarantee kicks in. There's a claims process, and then depositors are paid very promptly, and maybe have an opportunity to talk about the closed bank part of this panel a little bit later. But the debt guarantee program, and investors were looking for very, very prompt payment. Otherwise, the ratings that were going to be necessary in order to provide the liquidity outcomes that were desired from the debt guarantee program wouldn't come to fruition. And so there was that type of tweaking that had to be done eventually. Through a number of program modifications, they did occur, and the program was substantially enhanced, and I think ultimately was very successful. Over $300 billion dollars at its high point was guaranteed through the program, but it didn't come without some, you know, trepidation and angst over both the authority and then also just the mechanics of getting the program up and running.
Stress tests also developed on the fly, another program. Maybe Tim, if you could give us a little insight why this was so radical and why we didn't actually know what the losses were at banks during the crisis.
Sure, yeah. Well, thanks, Nellie. And thanks for having me here. I did notice, actually, that other than my former boss, Pat Parkinson, I'm the only supervisor on the panel, and Pat was only a supervisor for a very short period of time. So it's really great to be here, and I do want to acknowledge the hundreds of people that worked on these efforts from the supervisory side as well as all sides of all the agencies. So let me start with the obvious sort of radical aspect of the stress test, and I'll try to be careful here because my favorite lawyers are both in the room. One way at the back, but at the requiring firms to raise more capital when they were reporting capital levels that already met the requirements was a bit of a challenge. It hadn't really been done before in this way. And so the way I would phrase this, and I hope that I won't get in trouble this way, we basically redefined a supervisory expectation for what capital firms needed to hold to be safe and sound. Some would say we created a regulatory standard. I would say we didn't. That was something that was pretty radical at the time, because basically up until that point, all we had said is, in the terrific articulate way that we could over the years, was banks had to hold enough capital to basically be commensurate with their risk profile. As we all knew at that point in time, the banks had no idea what their risk profiles were. And none of us knew what the right amount of capital was, right? So that was the most obvious, real kind of radical change, if you want to call it radical. A couple other points that come to mind on that is, we had just spent the last 10 years working with supervisors and regulators around the world to develop Basel II standards, including Basel II's favorite stepchild, the internal models-based approach. And basically, what that was a carryover from what I would call sort of a deregulatory fervor that was prevalent at the time with GLBA and other things that basically said, the banks know best and the banks can model this stuff correctly. And the banks are going to develop through all sorts of really great financial engineering, good prospects, and they're going to tell us how much capital they need. That actually had been what we'd been doing for a long time, was moving towards in that direction. And so what we basically did here is kind of turn that all on its head, throw that all out the window, and in fact, we told the banks how they should be thinking about their capital, and we explained to them actually what we at the time believed was a better way to consider losses. And then that which leads to my last point probably is the use of scenario analysis. Whole bank scenario analysis was really, in a sense, is modeling the capital needs of a bank through all aspects of where that capital may come from and where the needs may come from. I think was a strong innovation, something we hadn't used before. We did make it. It's the wrong way to put it. We didn't make it up. We developed it on the fly through some tremendous work by a lot of people, as I said before. And so those, to me, are sort of some of the major aspects of why it was so radical. And I want to just say one more word on the other. We have to remember that prior to the crisis, we had a longstanding period of supervision where we really believed strongly that market discipline and banks' interest in self-preservation was going to lead to safety in the system. And so for supervisors, myself obviously being one of them, I came in 1995, so sort of grew up in that era, this was a real radical change where we were basically saying, oh, wow, market discipline didn't work, bank self-interest didn't work, now we've got to help the markets and the banks figure out what's going on. That was a really big deal.
Thank you. Some of the criticisms, and I'm going back to Dan and Lee, some of the criticisms of the equity injections relate to that we sort of gave a gift to the debt holders, that somehow we didn't do debt for equity swaps. And just, it sounds like, Lee, I know you all often talk about open bank resolution, and there's some element of some kind of swapping going on. I just wondered if you two could speak to that issue and what our authorities were and how we could address that issue.
Want to begin?
Say a couple things. So one, again, if you go back to what Dan and I were describing as the dynamic we were trying to break, there were runs throughout the system. And it was very important. We thought it was very important. I'm sure these guys did as well, to not pour gasoline on those flames. And we felt quite strongly that if we were to haircut senior debt, and I'll come back to the more junior parts of the capital structure, that if we were to haircut senior debt at a particular institution or institutions, no one would really believe us if we said, yeah, we're going to stop with those two. I think creditors of other institutions would likely be fearful and start running from them as well. Now, there are virtues in being able to use other parts of the capital structure. So if you go back to what we were discussing earlier, when we said we stand by ready to invest whatever we had to in the banks at the end of the 6-month period after the stress test, we also knew that we didn't have much capital left. We had 100 or 150 that wasn't already committed. There was a fairly thick, though not thick enough, layer of subordinated debt and preferred stock at these institutions. And Nellie mentioned open bank resolution. There's a piece in the chapter where we describe what happened with Citigroup. I won't get into the details there, but and Dan referenced this in his remarks as well. In the middle of the stress test, Citigroup approached us and I think recognized that they needed to have more capital and higher quality capital. And, our predecessors had, done a terrific job, put in the preferred stock. I think Dan called it, I wrote a note,
contingent common.
And it did turn out that way. Citigroup ended up swapping, the original bunch of the original TARP preferred and converted it to common, simultaneous with converting their other preferred stockholders and turning that into common as well. We were not going to haircut senior debt if it could at all be avoided. We did use other parts of the capital structure, and haircut's the wrong word in that context. It was converting debt to equity. It was all because we didn't want to accelerate what we viewed as a run on the system.
Anyone on the panel, what was one thing you thought about doing and then didn't do it, and why? So I'm just trying to dig into the whys about why this turned out to be so successful.
One idea that we had, a couple ideas. I made reference to initially the thinking at Treasury had been to purchase assets rather than inject capital. And as I described, we ultimately rejected that because we thought the capital injections would be faster and more efficient and more powerful. The asset purchase idea, as it was researched further, the best scenario would have been we would have been running test auctions sometime in December for a few hundred million dollars. And then if those went well, we'd be, the idea would be about $5 or $10 billion a month thereafter for several months. And that's a very long timeline given the circumstances that we were facing in early October. I'd say the second idea we thought about with respect to the capital purchase plan was whether there should be an element of market discipline introduced by requiring participating companies to go raise qualifying capital, you know, go raise common equity, and then the government would match with preferred or something else. And that was an entertaining discussion for a brief period of time. Conceptually, seems like a nice idea, but practically speaking, the market was closed even to the strongest, most well-capitalized institutions, so we dismissed it as unworkable.
I guess I'll jump in with one, and speaking for myself only, I guess, but one of the things that I think everyone was thinking about, I say after saying I'm speaking for myself only, is the resolution mechanisms, right? Ways in which you could split apart large, complicated institutions and possibly hive off a bit here and a bit there. And due to the lack of, you know, planning and attention given to that prior to the crisis, we found our situation where, in fact, you know, I think some of us were quite startled to discover the extent of some of the connections within the organizations that didn't seem to necessarily exist for a economic purpose, but for a variety of purposes that make it almost impossible to pull them apart in a rapid manner. And I think that that is something that we had to dismiss rapidly because it just wasn't possible. Hopefully, it will become more possible as time goes on. But.
I guess I would just say we considered lots of the same things that our predecessors considered and ended up not doing them for the same reasons they decided not to do them. Lots of them sound really good. When you first talk about them, they all sound much better, much more palatable than what we did. They would have been much more politically palatable, I guess. But when you dig into the details of what each would entail and what the downsides to them are, we reached the same conclusions as they did.
I would just talking about PPIP earlier, say that, I don't think it's necessarily an either or. I don't think it's either, you know, basically a capital injection or asset purchase type programs. But the question is, should one have complemented the other, and should parameters have been set up for utilization of one versus the other differently? And so I think this is something to look at in the future, because certainly many other jurisdictions look at asset purchase type programs, bad bank type programs. RTC, in many respects, was a big bad bank here in the U.S. So the model is tested and proven in application elsewhere. And so the question is, you know, I think, you know, admittedly, a lot of this was thought of on the fly, and that's the reason why, you know, I think this type of program is extremely beneficial, because it lays the groundwork for hopefully continued thinking on these matters, so that when the next crisis hit, you don't have to sort of like say, it's going to be one program or the other, but you can basically have a more nuanced approach.
I agree with that, and I'd say the best time to plan for a crisis is before it commences, because once it commences, your options narrow based on market factors and political considerations and other matters. And so I agree, it's not necessarily an either or. There's tools to be developed and considered, and they ought to be done well in advance of the next crisis.
So I have some questions from the audience. This first one is not in the form of a question. It says, call on Hank. So I'll call on Hank.
So thanks. I have one observation, then I do have a serious question. But the observation was this. I know Dan alluded to it, but I just want to mention context. After Congress passed the TARP, that week was a nightmare. There was rather than the markets calming, that there was panic around the world. Seven European nations need to step in and prop up their banks. When Jim made the comment about moving on the fly, I was just thinking how grateful I was, because we announced programs knowing they weren't perfect, and then you all worked around the clock to fix them, tinker with them, and make them work. But my question is this, and maybe it's more for Tim than the others as an examiner, which is one of the things that struck me when I arrived in Washington was the extent to which regulators felt financial institutions, banks, were adequately capitalized or more than adequately capitalized when people coming from Wall Street, although their behavior might indicate that they thought they were, knew that they weren't, okay? That when you look at the leverage that was embedded in terms of derivatives and all sorts of contracts and so on, and what was it? Was it just an, you know, maybe not using scenario analysis? Was it an antiquity, an outdated way of looking at it? Was it regulatory capture? Really, what? How do you look at it, and how do you, as you think back on that?
Yeah, that's a great question, and I'm really glad that you asked it. So, I would say that in my time as a supervisor, for the most part, leading up to the crisis, there was a very strong view that if the banks thought they were adequately capitalized, they were adequately capitalized. Right? The banks should know best. They had a self-interest in holding the capital that would make them safe. That was very much behind the whole supervisory framework that we had. Now, we didn't leave it at that. We had some minimum requirements, of course. But there was a strong belief that we should not push too hard against these people who were clearly somewhat smarter than us. I'm just being blunt, right? That's really what it was to some extent, right? So the idea that the bankers thought that they weren't adequately capitalized puts me in a very strange position because it's their job to ensure that their firm is adequately capitalized, right? So it's an interesting question, and that may be too simple of an answer, but maybe we fell prey to, you know, the bad math of financial engineering, where people would come and say, look, there's no loss in this exposure I have to a financial guarantor. And we're like, yeah, you're right. How could you lose? It's AAA, right? When the banks, to your point, knew very well that actually what they were doing was managing P&L. They weren't buying insurance. They knew there was no insurance. They knew those people could not pay them if they actually ever had to in a really down, serious downturn. They were managing their P&L volatility associated with the derivatives. So anyway, it's a great question. That's maybe not the perfect answer, but I think you have to get into the mindset that it was expected and taken as a given, I think, across many supervisory agencies, that if the banks knew best and they knew what they needed, right, and their shareholders and the markets would discipline them if they stepped outside of that. And I think we became way too comfortable with that. And so I'm really, you know, happy to see the changes that have come since the crisis, where we've actually said, you know, look, maybe you don't. And I guess as we all learned, they didn't. So anyway, it's a great question. We could probably talk about it for a long, long time. But,
Okay. I have a couple questions that relate to sort of the public capital versus private capital situation. So one is, you know, how did you think about the role of private capital in designing the public capital? And then this kind of dilemma of if you want them to take private capital, why are you making public attractive? So just trying to address that kind of what seems on the surface a dilemma.
Speaking for the program that we initiated, we wanted private capital return, and we thought an effective way to accomplish that would be having this preferred, which would be less dilutive than had we made a common investment. We also had incentives in the preferred for repayment. It had to be repaid by qualifying capital, so that was further encouragement for someone to exit the program. Having accepted it, they had to go raise qualifying Tier 1 capital and high-quality capital to replace the preferred, so that was an incentive for them to go raise high-quality capital. We also had a feature in the warrants that were introduced, where they could reduce the amount of warrants outstanding if they completed a issuance of qualifying capital by the end of 2009, which a number of institutions did so. And so those were, in our thinking, those were the steps that we took to encourage further private capital raising.
So I'm not sure what to add to what I already said. I mean, these guys had put in the public capital, the government capital early on. It was crucial. It was vital. And I think, you know, I included the words on this slide, private beats public if time allows. And those are important words. The fastest way for them to get capital into the system, I don't want to speak for you guys, but when they were doing it, was to do what they did. We had, I don't want to say we had the luxury, but we had some time to develop a program that would allow us to pursue a private capital approach. We thought it was more desirable for the reasons that, you know, that I mentioned earlier. But B, again, we didn't know if we had enough of our own, and had no choice but to bring private capital to bear.
I mean, a significant component of the private capital raising was the retained earnings that the banks began to earn in 2009. Right, the earnings recovery helped quite a bit.
Some of the banks had earnings in the first quarter that helped. I mean, I think where earnings really came in Tim may have touched on this earlier. The stress tests were a forward-looking, was two-year forward-looking exercise, and one of the components was the pre-provision net revenues. So it was the two-year forward earnings that the banks would have as part of the stress test analysis. And that was key. I mean, one of the dynamics, I don't want to go down a rabbit hole here, but, you know, one of the dynamics that was going on in the early period was there was a tension or a tug of war between those who thought we should mark banks to market and those who said that's, you know, we don't want to change the rules of the game, you know, midstream. But there was a large contingent in the marketplace that was looking at asset prices and saying if banks had to mark those to market, their earnings would be much worse. Banks look a lot worse when their assets are at 40 cents on the dollar than when they're at 80 or 90 cents on the dollar. And the way that these forward-looking pre-provision revenues were treated in the stress tests, I think appropriately, took into account the fact that there would be these positive revenues, both in the first quarter, as you were mentioning, Dan, but also going forward. And I think that was important. And I think the markets weren't actually focused on that before that period.
Yeah, well, maybe I'm just going to add a little bit to that, if I could. The whole mark-to-market question that was going on at the time, what they were really talking about is marking to market the assets of the banks. Mm-hmm. Right? What the stress test really attempted to do, and just to be clear, most of those assets are actually only marked to model. They're not marked. There is no market for a lot of those assets. What the stress test really attempted to do was mark to model the entire bank, including its earnings. And then with the outcome of that model being how much capital do they actually have. So I don't know if it's quite as distinct as we make it, but I mean the idea of just marking to market the assets of a bank and ignoring all other aspects of it, I think is problematic, and I'm glad that we didn't go that route. But
So I have a few questions that are somewhat trying to second guess a little bit, but I'll let you guys try to tackle some of these. So was it a mistake to allow the banks to pay dividends during this period?
Yes.
Did you have authority to do otherwise?
I think we always have authority if we're concerned that it's a safety and soundness issue at the bank to require them to stop paying dividends or to even to raise capital. We did not take advantage of that authority. And I think in hindsight, certainly my own perspective, I don't work at the Fed anymore, so I don't have to say this is not the view of the bank. it was a huge mistake. A tremendous amount of capital was paid out. Were paid out to their investors that then had to be made up either through further capital raises or government capital injections.
So that was more clear than I thought.
although Nellie, I want to actually bring up a little bit of analogy to this with the deposit insurance fund, because one of the tensions that was presented to the FDIC board during the crisis was basically how to ensure that the deposit insurance fund had one, basically the capital, basically to ensure confidence among depositors that the FDIC would be willing to and capable of honoring its deposit insurance obligations, even though it was fully backed by the full faith and credit of the U.S. government. You know, depositors, there was just a constant drumbeat in the media about the health and wherewithal and vitality of the deposit insurance fund. And the concern was that basically if the FDIC fund balance became negative, that there would be a time lag or in which it would be able to honor its deposit insurance obligation. Second element is liquidity, is that does basically even regardless of what the fund balance is there sufficient liquidity for the FDIC actually to meet its obligations? And so at the time of when you're in a crisis and capital is difficult to get or costly, it's not the time in which you are to be bolstering your capital levels. And with the FDIC, it was restricted prior to the crisis in its ability to take the deposit insurance fund beyond 1.25%, basically. There was a minor legislative change just beforehand, but it was too little too late. So in essence, you know, it was capped and didn't assess insurance premiums except in some rather exceptional circumstances for basically 3 years prior to the crisis. And then when the crisis hit, it was faced with having to make a special assessment, and then, which is something it didn't want to do, and then basically it did have to ask the banking industry to prepay its deposit insurance premiums, which was, once again, a rather novel approach. But this is really analogous to what Tim was talking about with respect to dividending at banks, is that there is, in good times, there's the pressure to not bolster your capital levels, and then when bad times hit and you need the capital, it's very difficult, and you're faced with some very tough decisions at that point in time.
I would have great respect for Tim and his observations, but I think I may disagree with the conclusion about dividends because it goes back to the premise upon which we were rolling out the CPP program and our desire.
Common dividends?
Common dividends, yeah. Okay. So there can be debate on this. So this will make it more interesting than if we all agree. If you accept as a premise as sound that we wanted to encourage broad participation and we wanted everyone to participate, including the strongest institutions, I think imposing a condition that they had to cease the payments on their common dividends would have frustrated that objective. And as a consequence, I think people would have not participated in the program, then the program would have been converted instead of a broad-scale recapitalization, it would have been converted into triage for the most distressed institutions. And that's the path we didn't want to go down. I'll ask Ben or Tim or Hank to comment on it.
Reasonable argument.
Yeah.
Imposing, you were imposing, your will on the banks. So, again, that's maybe a different question.
Nellie, can I ask a question? How do you guys answer the following question puzzle? So, the regulatory system was. For capital was badly designed and inadequate in the moment, as Tim said, and only applied to 40% of the financial system. It was not designed for the extreme shock, not adequate to that. People were very worried about solvency in the system in the fall of 08 and certainly early 09. As Lee said, loss estimates people were banding about in early 09, even early 09, were like, you know, north of $1 trillion. Yet in the end, the incremental capital needs identified in the stress test were tiny relative to those expectations, did not require any further injections of public capital, except for GSEs and some contingent AIG stuff. So how do you square the circle and explain why, if the system was perceived to be insolvent, was it resolved and the solvency concerns dissipate so quickly and so effectively on the strength of a disclosure exercise that resulted in modest incremental capital requirements? This is not to diminish the coolness of the stress test and its effect.
I'm tempted to say PPIP. not sure where to go from there. No, look, I do think there is something to, like, the, a lot of those loss estimates were looking at, you know, prices of assets in the market. And again, if you say these things are trading at 40 cents on the dollar and these banks have a lot of stuff that looks just like that, therefore I'm going to, you know, look at that institution through that lens, it can look in the moment as if they're insolvent. And loss estimates were based on those market prices. I do think, you know, going back to the way the stress test was designed, it didn't look at those market prices. It said, what are the, and Tim will correct me if I get this wrong, but what are the losses that this institution can expect over the next 2 years due to non-payment on those loans or assets? Not, gosh, it's trading at 40 cents on the dollar. And by the time, you know, as the next period unfolded, those assets had come back. So that's one. I don't want to say that's the whole thing, but I do think it's part of it.
Go ahead and I'll add something.
All right. So this reminds me of a question that one of the FDIC board members who was a supervisor would ask every time one of the institutions that was supervised by the agency failed, and we'd come up with loss estimates that were, you know, like, you know, in the millions of dollars for, and these are small community banks, and yet the prompt corrective action regime requires basically the institution to be closed roughly at 2% capital, roughly, give or take. And so why was it constantly, time after time, the FDIC would be incurring losses if, in fact, the institution was supposed to be being closed at 2%, roughly 2% capital? Of course, the reason is because the expectations are different. In one case, it's a going concern. You're looking at the intrinsic loss associated with the asset. And if the institution is a going concern, it doesn't have to take the additional discounts the market imposes on the assets for liquidity and risk. That basically is already there at the institution, and what the institution is essentially doing is just looking at the life of loan, life of credit loss associated with that. And it is a bit of a flip of a switch that a going concern value is going to have a different outcome and a different perception compared to gone concern. So you could have analysts looking at these institutions during the crisis saying if they failed, or this is what basically the insolvency is associated with them, that would be one number. But on the other hand, if in fact they remained as going concerns, it was a different number altogether. And this is seen time and again with failures that the FDIC actually handles in closed bank scenario. And under our prompt corrective action regime, where institutions are purportedly closed with a de minimis level of capital, but in fact they end up costing the deposit insurance fund money.
I would add a couple of comments, maybe offer an idea for consideration. One is, I think part of the analysis was not simply numbers on a piece of paper, but the fear that surrounded the numbers. And this will now take us to our theme of how vital and important it is to have very clear declarative communications about what our objectives are when we take actions. We made a number of fits and starts along the way. And that was, I think, reflected the capacities that we had at the time. And as we developed a full range of capacities, including the TARP authority, then we were able to be more resolute on our desire and intent not to let systemically financial institutions fail. Even having said that, though, I don't think it became clear until, let's not have a presidential transition in the middle of the next crisis. I don't think it became clear until sort of the first quarter of 2009 that sort of nationalization was off the table. And I think that was a significant fear, which was, and once resolved, that in addition to the data provided by the stress test, I think lessened the fear and increased the confidence.
So I would just add, which is a little bit along what Jim was talking about, that I don't think it was a foregone conclusion that the losses couldn't have gotten that bad. I mean, part of the effort in this program was actually to try to create some certainty in the markets to restore some confidence so the firms could continue to operate. Relates to back to that point. It may well have been a failure, and the losses could have been tremendously larger than they turned out to be, which I think is sort of where Jim at, but I'm thinking on the system. So,
Nellie, I would just add, I just want to emphasize what Dan said from our perspective. I think that the fear of quote nationalization and all that that would entail with respect to potential creditor haircuts, dumping of assets onto the market, was a quite significant factor. I couldn't agree more with that.
Okay, I have I'm going to follow up with two kinds of questions. The first is sort of moral hazard and fairness and justice and justness of the programs, and this responds to a few of the questions here. I think we've convinced people that, it was very important to save the banks, and why did you save the bankers is a question. And, how was fairness or moral hazard considered in developing some of the programs? So that's it. And then that's the first question.
Dan?
So clearly moral hazard is a risk and was a factor in our minds as we contemplated the actions that we undertook. I would say that we weighed that risk against the risk of a cataclysm in the system of default and the systemic breakdown. And in judging those two risks, we thought it more important to avoid the systemic breakdown than establish a point that we were not going to encourage moral hazard.
I'm going to just take your question and reframe it slightly, and that is I think one of the takeaways from the crisis is that it becomes very difficult to balance long-term moral hazard, accountability, market discipline objectives, which are embedded in many of the policies in the regulatory sphere, with short-term needs. And it's extremely difficult in the moment of crisis to start, weighing the pros and cons on this, because you have to ultimately balance the two. And to the extent that some planning and advanced thinking can position policymakers to avoid being forced into that position would be helpful. I'm not sure you can ever get there 100%, but to minimize that so that you aren't faced with then the outcomes that here, for example, the capital purchase program is immensely still to this day unpopular because of the moral hazard issue and the banker fairness issue, yet it clearly, on an economic basis, was very successful. So it is one of those I'll call it dilemmas that, once again, if there's maybe some additional planning, maybe policymakers in the future don't have to be quite in as difficult a position as they were in 2008.
I'll just go back and say, I think I said it in my introductory remarks, we failed to identify an avenue to aid banks without aiding bankers. And that's a feature of the program, a regrettable one.
Okay, last question for anyone or all of you. So when you're in a panic, you're always working with very limited information. You're working in real time. There's lots of uncertainty. Anything you know now that you wish you had known then? And, you know, is there something
I wish Hank didn't know my phone number.
Done? You know, that we could fix so that this doesn't happen next time.
So I'll take a quick stab at that. I mean, someone said it earlier, right? The best time to prepare for a crisis is before the crisis happens, right? And I wish we had known before we got into that crisis that we were going to find ourselves in a situation where the banks, the regulators, the supervisors, nobody had the information that they needed to actually understand what was going on with the losses in the system. That's unacceptable, right? And so that's something that not only can policymakers change, they have changed that to a great extent. Obviously, you can never have all the information you need, but just more preparation, more work on resolution and recovery in advance, like get those things sorted out, make sure you have the data and the understanding, make sure that the regulators have the authority to quickly take action to restrict capital outflows from firms, et cetera, et cetera. And many of those things have actually been done since the crisis. There's obviously a lot more work to do, but that would be my answer.
Yeah. I'm going to sort of just take a little bit of a turn here in that the we've been looking at capital just as like preferred and common shares, sort of like your core equity. But the reality is that in looking at how to deal with the resolution of a systemically important institution, there's contingent capital that could, or bail-inable capital. And so, I think one of the takeaways from the crisis is that maybe we should have beforehand been looking at what type of capital could be bailed in and setting market expectations for that ex ante. Because now, whether or not that's just convertible debt or something else, it kind of remains to be seen. But the reality is that there's a little bit of setting of the table that needs to take place. But if market expectations are such that the capital is available, but it's not necessarily equity, but it's available in the capital stack, I think it sort of serves a lot of the purpose that, we attempt to strive to achieve.
Now, Nellie, just before we do it, just
beep pip.
Well, yeah, another time. Just in my eagerness to make sure to compliment our predecessors and our colleagues at the Fed and others, I did neglect just a couple of groups, and I see some of the folks from the New York Fed who are out there who, during the early parts of the transition, in particular, were invaluable. We knew a lot more and were a lot better off for by virtue of their efforts than it would have been a worse disaster by far if it weren't for them. And second, of course, my partner Matt Kaybaker, who is also a co-author on this paper and did a tremendous job as well.
Thank you all. We're going to take an hour break.